Welcome to The Human Beat. I'm Roger Rocca. The North Coast Land Conservancy completed a very important purchase last month, securing 340 acres on Tillamook Head and protecting an entire watershed. It seemed a good time to check in with Executive Director Katie Volke about the significance of the purchase and what the North Coast Land Conservancy is all about.
Well, Katie, you may have been asked this before, but how did you become involved in the Land Conservancy?
Well, I was a young biologist, and I had the pleasure of working all over the state of Oregon with the Forest Service and Department of Fish and Wildlife, and that led me to a job on the Oregon coast counting Chinook salmon down in the Nehalem during the fall runs. And so while I was out here, I met some great people who were volunteering with the Land Conservancy and went out to plant trees one day, and one thing led to another. That was 11 years ago.
I think for a lot of people, they hear conservancy, and there's a land conservancy, there's a nature conservancy, and it's confusing. So can you tell us what a land conservancy is and how it may differ from, say, a nature conservancy?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're a local land trust. There's land trusts all over the nation, well over 1,000. And we serve just this area on the North Oregon coast from Astoria down to Lincoln City. The kind of work all land trusts have in common is that we work with willing private landowners to bring exceptional, special pieces of land into conservation, so into the public benefit, and protect it for those reasons forever. And so a group like the Nature Conservancy, that's very commonly known, also started out as a traditional land trust, is now a global organization. So very similar work, but they're doing it at this massive scale, you know, all over our globe. And local land trusts like ourselves, we choose our little spot and focus on that.
What benefit is there in what you do for the average, you know, average person? Why should they care? What's the benefit of your work?
Well, we always say, you know, our common ground is the ground itself, and all of us out here on the coast have something in common, which is that we live off this land, whether directly or indirectly. So we breathe the air, we drink the water, and we might also fish the fish and hike the trails. And so all of that's coming from the land in a lot of different ways. And because of that, we want to be able to keep the Oregon coast healthy and thriving so that people, plants, wildlife, all of us, you know, can be here and live in harmony.
Well, when you have land, when you acquire it, do you try to sort of return it to a natural state, what it might have been like before we were here, or how does that work?
Yeah, it's kind of like that. Some of our lands, really a lot of what we look at is where are those pieces that are still just in super great shape, totally intact natural systems. Those are where we can focus our limited resources and make the biggest difference, because they already are great, and so we're just trying to make sure that they remain in that wild state going forward. And then other times, you know, there's key places on the landscape where it might be a big connection between two state parks, for instance, you know, so being able to create a corridor there would be really valuable for wildlife and fish. And but maybe it's been altered from its natural state. So in that situation, we also would find that to be a high priority, and then would work on stuff like planting trees or bringing in native plants to get it back to its natural state.
One of the things that is important, I think, that you focus on too, is getting connectivity between the pieces that you acquire, so
yeah,
you get a more extensive natural area.
Yeah, it's really key, and at this point, it's really North Coast Land Conservancy's guiding light is that principle of connectivity. You know, when we started 30 years ago, it was with one piece of property, and that was very exciting. It was 5 acres on the Neawana in Seaside, and but since then, there's just been some wonderful, I would say, visionary work in looking at our whole service area and finding those places where there is already a state park, there is a marine reserve, there is a national park, something like that, where we can do a small piece that contributes to this very large whole and bring it together.
I want to go back and ask a little bit more about how the North Coast Land Conservancy got started, but what you just said kind of leads us into a big thing that's just happened in terms of an acquisition that you've had.
Yeah, yeah, just a couple days ago, we completed one of the largest acquisitions we've ever done, and it's on Tillamook Head, that iconic headland in South Seaside. Its name is Boneyard Ridge, and it's big 340-acre watershed, complete watershed of Boneyard Creek, and it brings together Ecola State Park and Circle Creek down in the floodplain, where that place where the highway used to flood. And so those pieces all come together with this watershed connection, bringing us all the way from ocean, you know, over headland, down into the floodplain and the river corridor. It's just ideal.
And all the critters that we live with here on the North Coast, I know have got to really appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, something like a whole watershed, when you can be such a more effective steward of an area where all the water that's flowing into that stream is your responsibility, because different management next door, you know, doesn't affect it so directly. And so even though 360 acres is nothing compared to, say, Yellowstone, it's wonderful out here for that kind of connection to Ecola State Park, where there are still large, you know, large animals and rare critters, and to have that whole water corridor area turn back into a rainforest is just going to vastly increase, you know, the potential for their habitat.
You mentioned where the highway used to flood. How come it used to flood and it doesn't flood now?
yeah, it's our property there is on the lowlands, so just west of Highway 101. And back in the 60s or so, there was a levee put on the property in an attempt to keep it from flooding. But it's such a dynamic place down there. It's where all the rivers and watershed comes together in the floodplain. And so the levee wasn't effective in keeping the water off. And so the development there that had been planned was abandoned, but the levee remained. Mm-hmm. And because of that levee, instead of the water being able to flow onto its natural floodplain, it was blocked by this levee, so it needed a low spot, and the new low spot was the highway. And so we removed the levee in a great partnership with the county and all the cities around here and ODOT. We removed the levee a couple of years ago, and since then there has not been a full closure of the highway.
Yeah. That's been because it was an annual event.
Yeah.
Before, that highway would be closed at certain times of the year, or at least the water would be so high that only certain vehicles could go through.
Yeah, and it still gets on the highway for sure, but it's probably at least a foot, if not 16 inches different, you know, lower than it was. And that's, of course, great for the highway and all the people. And then that effect of the flooding happening on our property, it just re-enriches and brings all of those nutrients onto the land that have been missing for all these years. It's like, each flood is a big fertilizing event for the floodplain, and so all the plants and the fish and all the species that use it, you know, they're just going to have such a more enriched habitat now.
So the flooding itself is not a bad thing. It's where the flooding is.
Yeah, I think flooding is really only bad for people, you know. And so it's when it's going over our infrastructure that it's a problem. But, you know, if it's not affecting that, it's a really critical and can be a really helpful part for people too, because if the water can go into a natural storage area, you know, then it's not going to affect our infrastructure. And that's what wetlands and floodplains are. They're big water storage tanks.
Yeah. How do you do what you do? How do you manage to acquire this land? You're not an organization that has millions and millions of dollars at your disposal. How do you bring that about?
Yeah, we basically have no money and no power, so it does seem like it wouldn't be possible. But I have to say that's some of the part that's so great about it, because it can only come together if there's essentially will within the community for it to come together. So it's just a positive experience. The way that it happens is different each time, but earlier, you know, I said we work with with willing private landowners and communities. And that's just a really critical part of our mission, that willing landowner. It has to be somebody or a company or a city who really wants this to happen. It's not that we've gone in and told them to try to make it happen. It's that they've come to us and for their own reasons and their own goals want to see something come into conservation. And that's where we can come together with folks, because it takes a lot of time to put these projects together. This one that happened this week started in 2011. Mm-hmm. And I would say that it went pretty fast, you know, considering. Yeah. And yet that was years of work. And so, you know, a landowner might come to us and tell us about a piece of land that they have. They might be willing to donate it, or they might want to sell it. And so the conversation starts there, and then it just all unfolds. We go look at the land. We see where it is on the landscape. Does it have that connectivity piece that's so critical? And if it does, then all kinds of work, you know, comes into place afterwards. And then if we're purchasing the land, raising money becomes a really big part of it. Mm-hmm. And so, like this one, we just purchased for $1.3 million, which is no small amount of money.
No,
and also why we would need years and a willing landowner to be able to do that, so that we could have commitment over time to be able to reach out to granting agencies, foundations, and also individuals who put up their own money, you know, in a philanthropic way for this sake of the greater good.
So I was going to ask you where the money comes from, and I think you just answered that already.
Yeah, it's always a big mix.
You apply for grants, you solicit donations.
For this one, we have over $500,000 that came from the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. So that's a state funding source. The one through lottery dollars is where that one comes from. Often we have a few different state or federal grants that go into an acquisition. This one was unique. We had an individual who gave a very large donation of $500,000 towards it. And so when we had those two come together pretty early on in the project, we still had, you know, $300,000 to go, but it made it so that when people gave an amount towards it, they were really building on a strong foundation already. So this project was largely funded by individuals through private donations, which is another thing that just makes it amazing to me that many people would rally around something to bring it into the public.
Are there benefits for the landowner that we might not immediately think of? I mean, obviously, if you sell land, you get money for it, but are there other things that a landowner gets from donating land?
Yeah, you know, if a landowner donates land, depending on different financial situations, there might just be a charitable tax benefit there. So that's often the case. When a landowner is selling the land, I think the benefit that they get in working with us is that they need to sell the land to reach their financial goals, but they want that land to be in a certain state. They love it for what it is. And, you know, often with families, you know, we might be working with families when there's generational changes. And, you know, the kids remember playing in the forest that was their grandparents, and it's a really special place for them. But, you know, we all have to survive in this world that requires money to make it all work. And a lot of times families have set up that's the way they can help their children, is pass down this land that then has value if you sell it. And so those folks, you know, if they reach out to us and we're able to work with them, it's just a really incredible win-win, because, you know, they can get to where their family's goals were, and also this piece of land, you know, gets to be protected.
Mm-hmm. Well, this land that you acquire is not sort of put into a museum or something. You you give the public opportunities to explore this land and see what it is and so on, don't you?
Yeah, we really try to as much as we can. You know, some of our lands you just can't even walk on, not because we say you can't, but because it's a swamp thicket that, you know, it would take an hour to go a couple feet kind of thing. And so those places aren't great for the public access. But every summer we put on a walk series where we lead guided tours, you know, all up and down our different properties along the coast. We have over 60 nature reserves that we're responsible for, and we try to get people out onto all the ones that are safe, essentially, is what our main goal is there. And then over and above that, there's a few properties where we really can invite the public to come on their own because they have a well-marked trail or a well-marked overlook. And Circle Creek is one of those properties, which is this floodplain at the base of Tillamook Head. And so actually on August 25th of this month, we'll be having a big 30th anniversary celebration party at Circle Creek, and we're also going to have the ribbon cutting for our two new trails that we've created out there. So that'll start to be a place where people can just come on their own and explore this really big, magnificent, special spot.
Is there going to be some kind of broad public notice of this so people will be aware when it's happening?
We're trying to get it out through things like this, either on the websites or on social media. There's little postcards all around. So hopefully just through word of mouth and seeing some of the different publications and things, you know, people will come out. It's a picnic. We're calling it a picnic at the barn. There'll be some presentations, some hikes. There's a pie potluck. Everyone should come and bring a pie. It'll be really fun.
Oh, you want my wife to come then. She makes great pie.
Oh, great.
Well, what is your website? Why don't we get that out?
It's nclctrust.org.
Okay. Well, it occurs to me that even for someone who never visits Circle Creek or never gets out on the land, there's still benefit because we're doing carbon sequestration where you are existent. We are encouraging wildlife. We are encouraging the fishery. We're doing all kinds of other things that benefit everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the kind of work we do. This land trust work is really that classic example of like think globally and act locally. And you know, no one person or group is going to save the world and keep this planet safe and healthy for everybody. But if we all do our part, then you can. And so, yeah, the direct benefits of being able to walk out there is wonderful, but the indirect benefits are global. You know, it does have an effect at that level. Air, water, salmon that migrate, birds that fly and migrate, you know, all of that. You need a lot more than just one little spot on the land to make all that happen.
Yeah, some of the land you have is obviously very moist. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what the difference is between a swamp and a bog and a fen?
Let's see if I can, actually. So as much as they don't seem like technical terms, they kind of are. And swamps and wetlands get a little bit interchanged. But, you know, technically a swamp is more related to having tidal influence. And so areas, you hear about forested swamps. And there's a lot of forested swamps along the Columbia River and along some of the big coastal bays. Anywhere where there's a forest right down in the estuary, there's tidal sloughs coming through. So that is a wetlands, but it's called a swamp because it gets that tidal influence. Mm-hmm. And then let's see, a bog and a fen. This one's really going to test me. Has to do with groundwater and surface water interaction.
Okay.
Yeah. And so so a fen, it has independent groundwater and surface water flow. There's a groundwater doing things different underneath the surface than the rainwater and the way the water above behaves. And then a bog, it all mixes and behaves the same.
Very good. So, and some wetlands, are they just rain fed? Do we have parts of the land that are just wet because of all the rain we get? Or is that different?
Yeah, you know, it's there's always, you have kind of there's saturation levels that just make it wet in the lowlands. when you're down in a floodplain, your groundwater is just close to the surface. You know, that's why you can drill a well and have drinking water for your house. And so, you know, the wetlands is because of the surface water falling on it. But if there wasn't a groundwater table close by, that water would percolate all the way down and it would dry out. So it's a saturation level that happens.
We have noticed that in places where people try to change the use of land and they try to fill what has been wetlands, it doesn't always work that well.
Yeah.
The wet kind of wants to be there.
It kind of wants to be there, yeah. I think especially out here on the Oregon coast, like the wet really wants to be here.
Well, take us back a little bit. How did North Coast Land Conservancy get started? Who was involved with that?
It was local boys in Seaside, essentially, that started to see that there were changes on the horizon. You know, more and more people moving out here, less and less people taking over the family farm. So there was going to be potentially some pretty big transitions of land. And those same people, you know, had a land ethic, an environmental ethic already as a part of them. And so they might have been involved in policy work or regulatory work and that kind of thing. And the way I've heard some of them describe it is that, you know, doing the policy work, the politics, the regulations, though it is important in its own way, it can just be really exhausting. And it's often a fight. And it can end in a collaboration and something good, but it's often a fight against something instead of creating something. And so that's what these guys wanted to do. They didn't want to keep fighting against stuff. They wanted to just be for something that people could rally around. And so land trusts were starting to pop up around Oregon. I think the oldest local land trust is about 35 years old. The Nature Conservancy's maybe been in the state for about 50 or 60 years. So it's all relatively new when it comes down to it. And these guys were kind of on the cutting edge of conservation in Oregon 30 years ago. And so it just started like that, conversations around a dining room table or maybe a round bar stool, and then educating themselves about the possibilities and starting to kind of put it out there in the public. And that's how it started.
And I see some of them are still involved 30 years later.
Yeah, there's a lot of wonderful, you know, maybe past board members that are volunteers. Our founding director, Neil Main, has been involved all of these years and still stays really connected. I have met a number of founding board members, and they just say thank you so much for keeping it going, you know, because they worked so hard to get it started in the first place. So it's very cool for someone like me to come in, you know, years later and still be connected to the beginning of the story.
Well, take us back now to this acquisition that you've just achieved. It's 300 acres. Do you know what the name comes from? Is it Boneyard Ridge that it's called?
Yeah, great question, because we made it up. And but,
well, then you know where it came
from. Yeah, so there is for a reason. So we owned the property Circle Creek, you know, down at the bottom. And when I first started, I started as the biologist. And so in 2005, I spent the whole summer walking the entire property of Circle Creek to do a big inventory, natural resource inventory. And there's streams that come onto the property off of Tillamook Head, and then they enter Circle Creek. And so I was looking at the streams and doing these aquatic inventories, and not all of the streams had names, and we needed to be able to talk about them. And this particular creek, it's a good-sized creek. It has spawning salmon in it and everything, but it is an officially unnamed creek on maps. And so, you know, how you'd say, oh, that's something by the big stump or the road over here by the big barn. Well, this one had a big pile of bones next to it.
Okay.
at the confluence from when hunters through the years would dress their elk. This was like the spot. And so there were these piles of bones from old elk carcasses. And so we just started calling it the Boneyard Creek, the creek by the boneyard.
Yeah.
And then it just, you know, it just evolved, and we just started to call it Boneyard Creek. And years later, I kind of forgot that it even was ourselves that had named it, you know. It just seemed like that's what it was called. And so since this acquisition is the entire watershed of Boneyard Creek, all the way to the headwaters that's on the ridge of Tillamook Head, that's how it got its name of Boneyard Ridge.
That's wonderful. That would make a fascinating whole study of where creek names come from. I just, you know, I'm just thinking we have Nat Creek nearby and Mary's Creek. And
yeah.
Who was Mary and who named Mary's Creek?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, what else would you like us to know about the North Coast Land Conservancy that people don't necessarily think to ask you, like me?
Well, there's always a way to get involved with the Land Conservancy, and people might not know all those many ways, I guess. We have each year well over 100 volunteers that help us do our work, and that's really critical to our ability to do it. And it's everything from people that help us in the office with different kinds of work, people that are out on the land helping with planting trees or pulling weeds. We have these walks that we do where we have at least, you know, 2 to 3 volunteers on that walk for guidance and for safety. And so there's just a whole lot of different ways for different abilities and skills to be able to get involved and show their support. So if it's something that is close to your heart, you know, you don't have to commit to being out in the mud in the middle of winter to be a part of our work. There's just a whole lot of different ways to do it.
You don't discourage people who want to be in the mud in the middle of winter, though.
No, I really encourage it. Call us today.
And for people who aren't able to do that for one reason or another, you know, they're busy with family, they're busy with work, donations are...
Donations are always accepted. Yeah, huge part of how we can make all this happen. Each year when I kind of look at our budget and numbers and, you know, make sure that we're spending reasonably and putting the money where we can make the biggest impact, we kind of average being able to turn any $1 that's been donated to us into $5 of conservation work. And so the contributions that come in to help us have our professional staff who's able to then go talk with landowners to make this kind of thing happen, to write the grants that bring in the millions of dollars to do a big purchase or a big restoration. We just wouldn't be able to do that without the individuals that give $25, give $100 a year. It's just the lifeblood of the organization.
Yeah, if the work speaks to your heart, it's another way that you can support it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, how does somebody do that? How does somebody either become involved in, at some level as a volunteer, or how does somebody donate?
Well, it's, I think, pretty easy these days to find it on our website and also call our office. So again, the website's nclctrust.org. There's some pretty bold buttons on there that say sign up to volunteer and make a donation. So those are two super easy ways to get started. All of our contact information is on there. And then calling our office, we still do things like use the phone and use paper mail. So that is still is always effective communication, and our office number is 738-9126.
And somebody could call and find out exactly what a volunteer position might mean, how much time it would take, what they'd be getting into before they commit.
Absolutely, and on the website we actually have this little inquiry form, and so if you click on that you're interested in volunteering, there's then a form, and it's like, tell us about yourself. What are you interested in? What do you like to do? You know, so that way we can get to know you guys if we don't already, and then we could be like, wow, we have this perfect project for this person and their skills, and so we always follow up those inquiry submissions on the website with a phone call to talk further.
Well, Katie, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, thanks,
and
Roger.
Congratulations on Boneyard Ridge.
Thank you so much. It's a very exciting one. And I hope I get to celebrate with people out there on August 25th.
We've been talking with Executive Director Katie Volke of the North Coast Land Conservancy. This is The Human Beat. I'm Roger Rocca.